The House Transportation Committee will come to order and welcome everybody. Today we're having a public hearing on House Bill 2120. And Patrick, if you want to just, as if we don't know, but let us know what we're talking about.
I will tell you what has appeared on the agenda over several days. House Bill 2120 creates the Transportation Utility Commission, period. Actually, it does a lot more than that, but that's what appeared on our agendas for a little while, so I just thought I'd mention that. This is the Governor's Jobs and Transportation Act. We have a panel of witnesses who will explain the bill in more detail, so I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. And with that, I'm going to ask Matt Garrett to come forward.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Matthew Garrett. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. It's a pleasure for me to be here today to share some thoughts about House Bill 2120, the Jobs and Transportation Act, or JTA. I believe that transportation is essential to Oregon's economic health, and I would submit that Oregon's economic future depends on maintaining, operating, and strategically investing in an efficient transportation system. Now, before I go into speaking to the JTA and then follow up with Mr. Bernards and Mr. Warner on kind of a more detailed overview, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the work of the Vision Committee. This was a committee chaired by Pat Wrighton, the president of Pacific Power. His committee laid the foundation for what would become the Jobs and Transportation Act. Mr. Wrighton oversaw a coalition of transportation stakeholders that represented the traditional stakeholders, AAA, the trucking industry, the cities, the counties, the MPOs, contractors, labor, the trade, as well as legislative interest. And again, I'd like to take this time and thank Chair Beyer for the commitment of time she put into this effort. We're environmental groups, Thousand Friends, Oregon Environmental Council, again, that had input in drafting this document. And then there was extensive engagement by business and industry types, whether they had a statewide perspective or a regional approach. This was certainly a big table, a big forum, and it made for a better discussion and hopefully better decisions as we move this transportation effort forward. The bottom line is that coalition stayed at the table for over a year, made their recommendations, and I can say with confidence that they continue to engage aggressively on the many fronts as we enter this discussion on the Jobs and Transportation Act. The Jobs and Transportation Act was developed around five core principles, the first being creating and sustaining jobs. And again, I would remind the committee that for every $1 million in highway construction invested yields about 14 family wage jobs. Second principle was a statewide distribution of the investment, making sure that the investment ripples across the state of Oregon. Three, we incorporate sustainability initiatives within the document. The fourth is ensuring local decision-making, again, bringing forth the best and brightest eyes to inform this discussion, to inform its decisions. And the fifth principle was improving transparency and oversight. The Jobs and Transportation Act is a document that is forward-looking, and it proposes a comprehensive multimodal funding package that will invest over $1 billion each biennium in Oregon's transportation system. The JTA is supported by increasing vehicle fees, title and registration, fuel taxes, the gas tax, as well as truck taxes. Roughly $499 million flow to the highway portfolio, the roads and bridges side of the transportation system. It's split up 50-50 with our city and county partners. Let's pull back and look at the ODOT share. Of that share, a little over $227.5 million. $100 million is pulled out for modernization type projects. Of that $100 million, $50 is set aside and bonded to secure $600 million for specific freight bottlenecks, congestion relief type activities. On the multimodal side of the investment, we use lottery-backed bonds. Connect Oregon 3, $150 million, is proposed for that successful program that invests in aviation, marine, transit, and rail-type projects. We have $35 million set aside to purchase a train set. and an increase in the cigarette tax to go towards senior and disabled transit. It's a flexing of some of the federal dollars that flows to the Department of Transportation to the tune of $44 million. All told, a $234 million multimodal investment comes from the Jobs and Transportation Act. The Jobs and Transportation Act truly challenges the traditional ways in which we do business, promotes the concepts of least cost planning, where we look at both the supply and the demand and looking at the range of options to find solutions to address transportation problems. Patrick mentioned the Transportation Utility Commission, an issue of governance. Again, looking at the way we govern transportation across the state. Are we optimizing the funding for the transportation system? Here's an opportunity to look with a comprehensive lens at the perspectives of the whole transportation asset, looking at its revenues, looking at its expenditures, making sure we're maximizing what we have here. It looks to streamline environmental permitting. Again, going to school on the efforts we've engaged in with the OTIA Bridge program, looking at programmatic permitting to reduce time and reduce cost, creating environmental performance standards, again, not lowering the bar in any way, approaching it in different manners and forms. It promotes green technology embedded in this document. You will see the encouragement of the use of electric vehicles twofold. In terms of the economic benefit as well as this green technology promotion. The greenhouse gas reductions are affected by this direction as well. Now, as I said, Mr. Bernard and Mr. Warner will walk through and give an overview, a section by section, so to speak, on the details of the bill. So what I'd like to do is close now and just with the following. The Jobs and Transportation Act, I believe, is a sound investment for the transportation system of today and of the future. There are costs associated with this investment, there's no doubt, but there are benefits. There are benefits to the overall transportation system, to those without jobs today, to our state's economic health, and to the citizens of Oregon. And these benefits are many, and these benefits are tangible. It is an investment that will continue to deliver dividends for years to come for Oregonians. So, Madam Chair, with that, I'll stand down, happy to take any questions or pass the baton to Mr. Bernard and Mr. Warner.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for Mr. Garrett? I guess you're going to get off easy right now.
Sounds good. Would you like me to stay here or sit back?
You're welcome to stay up
there. Okay.
And Mr. Bernard and Mr. Warner, and figure out who I'm going to call up Mr. Garrett again is what I was going to do, but... Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Hans Bernard, Governor's Deputy Legislative Director. By way of brief introduction, on behalf of the Governor, thank you for taking the time to hear this bill today. The bill before you represents nearly 18 months of work by various stakeholders in this room coming together around a common table to discuss primarily how we make strategic investments in Oregon's transportation system, but also, I think, a renewed goal of putting Oregonians back to work. The Governor's Jobs and Transportation Act will provide Oregonians with sustained and creating 6,700 jobs over the course of the first 5 years of the program, and ongoing will provide ongoing sustained investment into all modes of the transportation system. So by way of brief introduction, again, thank you for taking the time to hear this bill today. Chris Warner and myself will walk you through a section-by-section summary of the bill, and we'll remain here to take any questions that you may have about its contents.
Great. Chair Bauer, members of the committee, for the record, Chris Warner with the Governor's Office and the Department of Transportation. You should have before you a copy of the bill, but also a very good section-by-section analysis that looks at all 55 sections of the bill. And so what I'll do is just walk through it, and I guess the preference would be as we go along, if you have any questions, we can try to answer them. My understanding in visiting with the chair about this is As we go along, there'll probably be some more in-depth conversations about some of the aspects of the bill. So if we don't get all your questions answered, I'm sure there'll be other opportunities for us to make sure that you get all the information that you need. Section 1 deals with, as Director Garrett mentioned, the creation of a Transportation Utility Commission. Just as part of the background, we had a number of people working on the Vision Committee, and one of the things that came clear is that the existing revenues for the road system really don't match what the existing needs are. And so what the Vision Committee and what the governor adopted within the JTA was to try to figure out a way to actually bring kind of the needs to the system together and try to figure out a way to have someone other than the local bodies and all the other bodies really assess what the needs are for the system and have a way to kind of move forward with the funding mechanism. So one of the things that they recommended was the creation of this Transportation Utility Commission. Initially, it was given fairly limited powers in terms of what it would do, and what we looked at is kind of a way to prove itself as it moved forward. So I think part of that was a way to actually kind of put our toe into the water. One of the things that we had talked about within the Vision Committee was not to just do the standard kind of transportation plan where we, you know, raised fees and then, you know, just bought things, but I'll actually look at ways that we govern the transportation system, the ways we move forward. So the Transportation Utility Commission is a fairly comprehensive and a fairly significant way of looking at how we make these transportation investments and a different way of doing it. So as you can see through Section 2, this thing would sunset in 2012. Pending action on the 2011 session. So it's something we would bring back. So we do have a sunset, but to give the legislature a chance to kind of take a look at what we do over the interim, which would be 2010-11. So, and then Section 3, as part of, you can imagine, we had three very active working groups going at all the time. So a number of issues that we didn't know if exactly we had the answers, but we wanted to bring all the stakeholders in the department and smart people together to try and figure out how we move forward with some of these. So a number of task force and groups are called upon within the legislation to actually study some of these questions so we can actually have better answers as we move forward. For instance, the first one that's listed there is review the responsibilities given to state, county, cities for the improvement of the highway system to make resources available to each level to better align responsibilities. So we were looking at ways that we actually govern the system, and between the different owners of the system, as we say a lot, people don't know whether they're on a county road or a state highway. They just want their system to work well. So try to look at if it does make sense for the state to own some roads to give them back to the county. For instance, 82nd Avenue is one that came up. It's a state highway, yet it goes down right through the middle of Portland. So the question is whether or not that should remain a state highway, and talk about those jurisdictional issues. That's one of the things that group would look at. Best practices for stakeholder involvement. One of the things that we heard a lot is that people aren't necessarily, we get kind of processed to death a lot of times with these transportation projects. And it's not that you want to stop the debate, but what you want to do is take a look at maybe we could do it better so that you're actually enhancing the public involvement, so not only the citizens that are coming to talk to you feel better about the information they're giving, but the policymakers have a better chance to use that information. So we wanted to take kind of a literature review of what other jurisdictions do with public input to make sure that, not necessarily to do it different, but just to do it better. So we're not cutting off the debate of anyone, but we're making sure that the decisions that we are making and the discussion we have actually moves the process forward and doesn't just stall it in infinitum. Greater efficiency through the program delivery, intergovernmental cooperation. We find a lot of times that you get silos between state government and local government. So this way, try to find a way for governments to work better. So that's one of the recommendations we move forward. The next one deals with identify opportunities for greater efficiencies and delivery of the programs. The national best studies for improving the delivery of the metropolitan transportation services. One of the things we talked about is that would it be necessary for Gladstone, Oregon City, you know, and Milwaukee to have their own road departments and their own graders? So to try to look at ways that we could bring local jurisdictions together, particularly metropolitan areas, to see if there's a way that we could share those services. So those we've identified as those are a number of the studies that we would like to undertake as part of the department, the stakeholders, and all the other folks that are involved. It's a pretty big undertaking, and as you see, Section 4 would have the authority to repeal those done in 2014, so we just don't leave them on the books. So we would look at that as probably a one or two interim process to look at some of these issues that were identified through the governance and the vision committee process in order to make better decisions on transportation funding. Sections 5 and 6 dealing with a congestion pricing pilot program. One of the suggestions that came out of the study group was to see if we could find a jurisdiction that would be willing to do some kind of a pilot on congestion pricing. And congestion pricing is a way to price the roadway or the facility, whatever it is, based on the time of day and the use of the project. So we would the OTC would reach out to local jurisdictions to see if anybody would be willing to do that. Obviously, if none are, then it's not a mandate, but it's just a way to begin the process forward, and that in a lot of ways that leads to kind of what sections 7 and to 12 talk about. And you know, certainly as we rolled out the bill, this is one's gotten a lot of discussion, to say the least, and not only here but in Oregon, it's been a fairly significant national model. But all this the legislation do would direct the DOT to work with the federal government, other states, and transportation stakeholders to talk about the technology needed for this. Many of you may recall in 2001 the legislature authorized the creation of what's called the Road User Task Force, and their job was basically to kind of get on the forefront of figuring out where we need to go with transportation funding. As the gas tax has not kept up with inflation, as we're getting more fuel-efficient cars, as we get to electric and other kind of cars, I think there's an entire literature out there about how do we move forward with how do we fund our roads and bridges. If the gas tax, you know, which in many ways was a great funding source early on, but as we get the more fuel efficiency, it's just not keeping up. So to try to knowing that if we need to find a new way to fund things, we just can't do it overnight. So we've been trying to be fairly visionary. Recently the governor was talking when he was back at the National Governors Association and came up with Secretary LaHood, and the White House has not been entirely supportive, I think, at this point. But we do think that this part of the bill, all this does is kind of continue the pilot program. We don't look at it as any kind of an implementation. I think the governor sees that this wouldn't be implemented any time in the next decade or so. But certainly we need to keep at the forefront of this conversation because it's very important. And if something does happen on the national level, which Chairman Oberstar from the House Transportation Committee has talked a lot about, we want to be the kind of the ones that help guide that and not have it foisted upon us. So that's one of the things that we're very interested in with the vehicle miles traveled.
Representative Bailey, did you have a question?
I can wait, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, sorry.
That's right. Okay.
So Section 7 through 12 deal a lot with the VMT issue. Sections 13 and 14 talk about, as we bring the stakeholders together to talk about how projects are actually chosen, we are looking at creation of an interim project criteria process, and this would be for the 12-15 STIP. And basically what the Vision Committee did and the governor adopted was to kind of come up with what these principles would be as the stakeholders and the Transportation Commission get together to make the new criteria for the STIP. So you can see much of the discussion of these all talk about really improvements and investments that actually get the most bang for the buck and for improving state highway system for access routes by the state highway and a local road system, which means basically if we make enhancements on the state system, on the local system, and that helps the state system, is that a good way to spend your money? Enhancing safety for the traveling public, increase operational efficiency through innovation and technology. You can read these as well, but certainly what we're looking at as we're moving kind of to the next level, which I'll talk about at least in a minute, is at least cost planning. With least cost planning, we'll have a different kind of filter as we look at the way we plan our highway system, but certainly we wanted to give some guidance, especially with legislative input, on how we move forward with the next generation of the STIP criteria. Section 15 deals with the flexible funding for non-highway purposes. Director Garrett mentioned that. Currently, there is an amount of money that comes to the state from the federal government that is that has the ability to be flexed. And when I say flex, that means it can be spent on things other than roads and bridges. So what this would do would have the and those monies that we currently get that are not flexed, we spend because of the deficit we have in the road system now. So what this would enable us to do is to determine the amount that can be flexed and go ahead and flex that in a multimodal fashion as long as there are sufficient monies coming back from the new revenues that would actually supplant what would be lost for the highway fund. So it would be holding the highway fund whole, but also taking some of those additional dollars, which we can spend on other modes of transportation, and going ahead and spending them on other modes of transportation. So that would be up for the department or for the commission to actually make that recommendation, because there is there's a number of federal discretionary grants. So we need to be funded at a certain levels in order to be able to still apply for those federal discretionary grants. Section 16 deals with the environmental stewardship and green standards. We've talked a lot about the great success we had with the OTIA projects, and what this would do would actually make many of the work we've done with OTIA and make that in all the projects that we do with the state. So just kind of bringing those back into what we do in the state, make that kind of the general practice of the department. So we think that would be very good, not only for the system, but also for the environment. Least cost planning, and I think
Chris,
yeah.
I'm not seeing any questions there, but on that, I mean, I would think maybe that would be something that you wouldn't necessarily need us to tell you to do. Do you read this as something that you actually need authority to change?
Madam Chair, my belief is, and I think at least working in the working group, I think they felt it important that that it actually be memorialized and that the legislature kind of have their kind of blessing of that. So as we move forward, then, you know, as departments change and the standards change, we want to make sure that it's something that we can, you know, really put into law so we can actually move forward with it. So I think that was kind of the feeling of the group.
Thank you.
Least cost planning, I think Director Garrett talked about that a little bit in 16 and 17. It's basically a process to compare direct and indirect cost of demand and the supply options to meet the goals. So kind of the issue you talk about is, and what we traditionally in transportation planning have talked about, if you're on the Terwilliger curves, for instance, and you need to get more people through, the question is always, how do we put more lanes in? But with least cost planning, you look at other ways of finding out whatever the solution is, whether it's getting people through and maybe invest in some of the other roadways, more in transit. So having that extra filter in terms of how we deal with transportation planning. And so it's not just, you know, more, but also how we spend things and spend them smarter. So try to incorporate least cost planning into the way that we, the everyday business of the department. And also, it's important that it's not just the department, but also the local governments and the local entities, because it is a system. And if we all are looking at the least cost planning model, then that might be a way. So what we recommend is taking a look at that and reporting back to the legislature on how that works. 19 is a section dealing with use of electric vehicles. Currently, this is modeled on something that Washington State does. Currently, if you're an electric vehicle and if I'm come to a state facility, you can't just plug in. And so this would allow for de minimis amounts of electricity to be used for public purpose. So we could actually start doing charging at state buildings. That way, you know, it would be very... wouldn't cost the state very much money, but at least for the price of the electricity, at least the state could give that to the individual with the electric car, and so that we could try and encourage more electric vehicles. Sections 20 and 21 deal with the findings for the Cascade train. As you know, people that have been here before, the state has a train that goes between Eugene and Seattle, and so this would actually have us purchase some rail equipment to actually do that. We're currently leasing a train from Washington State, and Washington State wants it back, so we are trying to figure out a way for us to actually have the equipment on hand, and we've had some discussions. It's it's difficult. There's not like a used train store you can go to. You need to figure out a way to find this purchase. And so there are a number of other states that are moving forward with some purchases. So we were hoping that we could kind of incorporate our purchase of a train into that too, so we could actually, make sure that we have the service up and down the valley. Sections 22 and 23 are Connect Oregon 3. Connect Oregon 1 and 2 from the 2005 and 2007 session were $100 million investments in the multimodal system. So that's rail, transit, marine,
aviation.
So this would be continuing that program. So and this would be $150 million in lottery-backed bonds as opposed to the $100 million, which we've done the last two. These are competitive competitive grants. We've had a very good committee that's worked on that. So I think if you've heard about success of Connect Oregon 1 and 2, so this would continue that program for the multimodal system. Sections 24 to 27 deal with electric speed vehicles and would create a new category called medium speed vehicles. Currently under the statute we have what's called a low speed vehicle, which is a very low speed vehicle. The vehicle goes about 25 miles an hour. And then we have the regular speed vehicle, I suppose it's a car. And so what we're trying to do is try to find something in the middle. You'll see the zap cars that drive around. You'll notice the reason those have three wheels is because they go more than 25. But if you have three wheels, you're not a car, technically. So you're technically a motorcycle. So if you look on the license plate, it says, M5 or M6. So those are technically motorcycles. So this would create a new category of cars that go probably up to about 40 miles an hour, 35 miles an hour, so they could drive in a 40-mile an hour zone. So we have kind of a bridge between the low-speed vehicles, which for a lot of us isn't quite practical, but also so you don't have to take your car everywhere. So what we're hoping that might spur some, additional thought into alternative vehicles. It's something very similar that both Montana and Washington State are doing. So we're trying to kind of push the envelope a little bit in terms of getting some of these alternate vehicles that not only are cleaner but also probably use a lot less energy. Section 28 deals with something that we discovered in the Governance Committee dealing with co-location of state and local facilities. We've had some problems down in Klamath Falls in terms of the way the state budget is put together. The Klamath County wanted to work with us on co-locating a maintenance facility, but just because it was like an interim, we really couldn't get to it. So this would just place like a dollar placeholder in the budget process. So as we move forward, we might have those opportunities as opportunities come up with cities and counties in terms of co-locating facilities. So that can be a big money saver both for the locals and for the state. I could stop there, but now we start with the fees, so I probably will go on. Section 29 deals with, and as Director Garrett said, we the Vision Committee and the Governor, when we looked at this as a way to make the amount of investment we need to actually make a difference in terms of our transportation system and all the things that we need to get done. So we have a number of title fees and registration fees. So the first in Section 29 is increase the title fee, which is currently $55, and that would increase that to $110. So that's for the first time you purchase a vehicle. It would also create what's the next one is a first-time variable title fee of and that is based on the MPG of the car. So if your car gets over 30 miles to the gallon, it would be $50, and if it gets over, it would stay at the 100. So it would be 100 for the first-time title fee, but if you're car gets over 30 miles an hour, then you'd actually get a discount to 50. So that's a kind of a new way of looking at it, and that would also encourage folks that have more fuel-efficient cars. A section, and that was from section and 30 and 58, talk about the variable first-time title fee. Section 31 deals with the registration fee. Currently, Oregon's registration fee is $27, the lowest in the country, I believe. If not the lowest, second the lowest. And so this would add $54 annually to that to make it $81. And then we've also increased the fees for a number of other vehicles, mopeds and hybrid electrics and other vehicles. So that's that section. Section 32 is the governor had in the bill a gas tax increase of 2 cents per gallon. diesel tax increase of 2 cents per gallon. So those were the numbers that we landed on. And certainly as the deliberations went through the committee process, there were a number of, you know, different ways you could do this, a higher gas fee or lower title or registration fee. So I think they were fairly scalable in terms of trying to find out what the investment level you needed was and then try to figure out what it is. So those are the numbers that we'd come up with this in the bill, and I'm sure you'll have many discussions with folks on this.
Representative, can I ask you why?
Sure.
Page 10, line 44, and then through line 40, or the next page on the top, why the state registered cars and undercover vehicles are $3.50?
I'm sorry, what page? I didn't have the
book. Well, section 31, down on the fees, down at the very bottom, government-owned vehicles and state-owned vehicles and undercover vehicles.
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, those are what they are currently in statute, so they have. So I don't know why we didn't raise them. I think that's something I can go back and try to figure out.
I was curious why.
Yeah, actually, of all the registered vehicles, I've never seen that. So thank you for bringing that up. We'll get back to you on that. And then the next few sections, there'll be lots of blanks. And that basically deals with the commensurate truck and tax fees in terms of the cost responsibility. Cost responsibility. I get my models mixed up. So those would be plugged in terms of the two-third, one-third approximately. As Director Garrett mentioned, 37, 38, and 40 deal with the distribution of the funds. So the first thing we do out of the new revenues that are generated, we make whole the highway fund for the monies that are reverted to the multimodal account. We do that first, and then from there, then the dollars are split, 50% going to the department, 30% to the counties, and 20% to the cities. And then this probably happened in an appropriation bill, but since we only had one vehicle to move this forward, this ended up being in the policy bill. So this is how Legislative Council drafted, and this is the way it kind of ended up. And I think Director Garrett talked about the modernization funds, a lot of money going to maintenance and preservation and operations issues. Sections 39 and 46 deal with what we were calling the timber-dependent county safety net account. We had allocated some dollars to try to help the timber counties and the smaller counties in terms of monies that they were losing because of inaction on the federal level. Once the county schools fund monies were, I think we had that extension. So what we wanted to do was take that money instead of giving it to them now, since they're being made whole by the feds, to create a little bit of a trust fund. So when those monies do go out, there'll be a little bit of money left over. So that's what we attempted to do in that section. Then the next few sections deal with some of the local resources for mass transportation and transportation districts. One of the things that we had taken that we looked at was trying to figure out a way for local jurisdictions to raise their own money, not necessarily it's always coming to the state for that. So one of the things that this bill would allow is mass transit districts and transportation districts to levy a payroll tax of 0.8%, so it's 0.008 of whatever the amount you would owe. And then it would also allow the current mass transit districts that are will be at 0.7 to go ahead and move that up to 0.8. So that would be Lane Transit District and TriMet. And sections 43 and 44 would allow certain districts, and most of these have elected boards, to levy the either business license fee or payroll tax or income tax without first seeking approval. But the board, you know, with any kind of a tax measure, it's subject to some kind of referendum, and so it could be voted on. Section 56 repeals the requirement that for the Board of Directors of Salem Mass District to first seek a vote. This would allow them to implement it, but of course it would still be subject to referendum. And then repeals the 10-year transition from a maximum payroll of 0.6 to a maximum 0.7 of gross payroll That's more technical than you probably wanted to hear. Section 45 deals with spending for bike and pedestrian programs. Currently, increases set aside is one percent set aside. This would increase it to 1.5% in terms of bike and pedestrian facilities within the right of way. So that's that'll be great for our for some of the non-highway purposes. Sections 47 and 50 deal with I think Director Garrett mentioned the $600 million for the key bottlenecks. So that would be that's bonding money that we would have one-time bonding money to make those key investments. Section 51 is similar to a bill that I think was considered last session, allowing county commission, a duly elected county commission, to adopt a local vehicle option registration fee. So this would allow them to do it. If they didn't vote first, the county commission could do it, and of course that still is subject to the referendum. And then Section 52. Was one dealing with the plate manufacturing fees. Currently, we recover our costs, and the money that we get beyond that goes to, I think, cities. And so this would allow us through a little bit more money to recover our costs, so that way the local government would get more money because the costs to create the plates have increased. Section 53 deals with the operations. So we had kind of the capital side of the train. This deals with the operations. Currently, the Amtrak train, we give a small operating subsidy that's general fund based. So if we increase this is basically the vanity plate. So if it says, you know, Chris on the vanity plate, this would increase from $25 to $50. And those dollars would be used, for the operational subsidy. Last session, we got halfway there by some issues with the litter patrol and some dollars we could use there, for the passenger rail fund. And now if we do this, they'll be completely off the general fund. So they'll be on their own. 54 dealt with, hasn't been raised, and so we raise fees that the dealers use in order to process the car titles. We raise that by $25. And then Section 55 deals with what's called pay-as-you-drive insurance. Since 2003, we have had on the books a process where you work with an insurer, and so it's a more exact science in terms of paying as you drive, and we haven't had any takers, but our understanding is we just need to put the sunset out on this a little bit more, and I think some insurance companies are actually interested in this, so we don't want it to sunset, so we'd like to extend that sunset. So that's what we're trying to do with the pay-as-you-drive insurance, and then, of course, the effective date is January of 2010. So that is a quick run through the bill, so I think we're here to answer any and all questions you have, and look forward to working with the chair and all the committee members on moving forward with this bill. So, thanks very much.
Thank you, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I left the room for just a few minutes, so I may have missed it. But also, I understood in here is elderly and disabled transportation and the cigarette tax. And I mean, this is a continuous need, and it's not. Some of us are getting older. So would you expound on that a little bit? Yeah.
Thank you, Representative Berger, Chair Beyer. There are two components of what we have spoken of as the governor's transportation package that are not included in this bill today. One is the elimination of a tax credit for hybrid vehicles and a shift of that tax credit over to partial electric or all electric vehicles, and that is included in some of the legislation in the governor's climate change agenda. The second piece is the piece that you raised, and that is an allocation of 2.5 cents annually for elderly and disabled transit services out of the state cigarette tax. That is included in a separate cigarette tax bill that is being considered by the House Health Committee at this point, but is not included in this bill at this time.
Follow up.
Is it an increase of 2.5 cents to our current, or is it a reallocation towards senior and disabled? Because there's already an allocation piece.
It would be an increase above that allocation, Madam Chair, Representative Berger.
And what are we trying to buy with that? I know it's not in this package, but do you guys know? I mean, how much would we increase elderly and disabled?
Chair,
transportation options.
I think the 2.5 cents raises about $5 million. So that would be distributed to the transit districts, and I don't think there's. I don't think we've spelled out how we're going to spend it. I think it would be very similar to how we spend the current 2 cents. I think they get a current 2 cents on the cigarette tax, so I think they could use it for operations or capital. I don't think we've. I think they've talked about what their needs are, and they're more than $5 million. So it's not going to get all the needs, but it's going to hopefully ease the pain a little bit.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As long as we're on the topic of things that may not be in the bill, it was my understanding that in some of the initial concepts of the bill that there was a provision that would have included funding for a new planning organization for some of the faster-growing areas to help integrate transportation choices into land use and transportation planning. Could you speak a little bit to that process and what sorts of amendments there might be around that particular concept?
Certainly, Representative Beyer, Representative Bailey. There were some amendments to this bill that did not make it from the governor's bill drafting instructions through council, and because of some of the tight timelines that are placed on state agencies and the executive branch, we were unable to make those amendments before the bill was filed for your consideration. The governor will be bringing forward a set of amendments to this bill that include some fixes that have been recommended by the bond council in terms of some of the language that was included related to bond sales. The separate piece and the piece I believe you're most interested in is some language related to Metropolitan Planning Organization funding for integrating land use and transportation plans. That language was included in the bill drafting instructions in very conceptual form. There has been an external working group that has been working to develop that language in a more fleshed out way, and our anticipation is that there will be some language that comes forward to you at some time should the committee choose to put the bill into work session that can amend those pieces back into the bill.
I pursue a slightly different line of questioning, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Another question?
I'm also curious about the VMT fee. You mentioned in your testimony, Mr. Warner, and it appears from looking at Section 9 in the bill that there is some overlap or perhaps some synergy between the congestion pricing pilot program and the VMT program. It would seem to me that this might be the first step in sort of a bigger look at our transportation system and how we fund it. Could you give us a sense of the timeline on that and when we might see some of these changes?
Chair Beyer, Representative Bailey, we are certainly one of the things that we've been trying to work through is the technology. I mean, that we kind of worked with Oregon State and got the little machines put in the car. So we were able to do a number of the things. So what we're trying to do is figure out a way to work with, especially with the car companies, because I think these are kind of the outcomes in terms of road capacity reduction and identified by the commission. Those are kind of the outcomes. We're still trying to get to the technical way of being able to actually track that. And track is not the right word, but to find that information. So, I think those are some of the policy choices that will be made, I think, once we move to the point where we can actually start implementing a vehicle's mile traveled program. And those are the things that legislative bodies and others will deal with. We're still trying to kind of work through the electronics of actually getting there and in terms of the best way to implement it.
Final follow-up, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. Along those lines of the technology and the little machines, would you characterize those machines as providing the same, more, or less information about the vehicle user than, say, a commercially available GPS device in a car or a cellular phone? Or do you have that information yet?
Madam Chair, Representative Bailey, I think from the very get-go of this discussion, we've been very strong in terms of where we are in privacy, because that's going to be a huge issue, and I think Mr. Witte's been to talk to you. One of the offhand things that you kind of talk about is, I think, less. I mean, it's just information coming into the car, and then it's basically a click as to where it is. So the way I've talked about it is, you can hear your radio, but your radio can't hear you. It's one-way communication into the car. It's coming down, and then it just clicks where you were, and it doesn't go back out. So, you know, it'd be our expectation that it would be much easier to track someone with their GPS or their cell phone than it would be with this technology. And I think that's where I think we've tried to be the entire time is this is not about privacy. This is just about, you know, recording where you are. I call it a smart odometer. It kind of knows where you are, and it's just going to make a little click as to where you are. So I think that's a better way of describing where it is. It's not... I don't think it's nearly as nefarious as some might think.
If I may, Madam Chair, Representative Bailey, I think the bottom line, Chris used the word tracking. We're tracking mileage, and that's it. We just want to know how many miles are driven within the state of Oregon. So I think tracking mileage is really the intelligence of the technology right now.
No? Representative Schaffler.
Thank you.
And then I have...
We're going to, I hope, pass a package this year to and raise that money, Chris, that you talked about, and I've supported those things in the past, and I'll support them again, and I'm sure it's going to be a pretty good size of money and put a lot of people to work and improve our infrastructure, and we'll get down in the weeds and all that throughout the days and weeks to come, and I look forward to having those conversations, and I'm confident I'll vote for something. There's some committees and commissions in the state that work really well. The one that comes to my mind because of the committee I've been on for all four sessions is the Management Labor Advisory Committee. I think that's an example of a committee that examines ideas and concepts and subject matter and legislation and does a good job of, I think, capturing what the state where the state wants to go and doesn't create large amounts of controversy. It has broad bases of support. There's others that simply don't. They do just the opposite. And here we're going to create something. I'm not so sure we're going to. And give five people appointed by one person a lot of latitude, maybe control, power, influence. I am very reluctant, gentlemen, to do that. Matter of fact, right, I wrote no on the line next to it. It would take a lot to persuade me, and I'm not saying you have to have my vote, but I am very reluctant to create another commission that, in my humble opinion, is going to create a way to prevent and obstruct and deny things happening in the state. I'm very, very, in fact, right now I'm a no on that. But the rest of it, we'll get down in the weeds. There's some on yes, some maybe, some no, and some of these items. But overall, I know we're going to have to raise a good amount of money, and we want to share with our local partners and do what we need to do in this state. So I don't want to discourage you. I know I won't, but that one item is I'm not there. But thanks. This looks like you've done a lot of good work on it.
Thanks.
Representative Call, and then I have Pence.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Firstly, I'm trying to get my head around what Section 51 does, so if you don't mind. I lived through intimately Multnomah County's attempt to pass a vehicle registration fee in which they had to go to every single city within the county to gain permission before they could actually take their then proposed vehicle registration fee to the voters. This seems to remove the requirement of taking it to the voters, but keeping in play the spider web that was a pretty much impermeable obstacle towards passing that vehicle registration fee. Am I reading this correctly?
Chair Beyer, Representative Call, I think we tried to find consensus on a number of these as we could, and so certainly what we looked at, the model that we kind of moved forward with was what the bill that I think it passed the House and didn't quite make it to the Senate, that's the model we did. There probably will be additional conversations. I know that there were some folks within the cities that I think were wanted more discussion in terms of the spider web and if called the so-called spider web. If they had some more discussions on that, so I think that would probably be something that certainly could be talked about. Certainly, when we were putting the bill together, we didn't quite have the consensus there, and so I think there were some other discussions that probably may be happening right now. I don't know.
I just moving a little more deeply into Section 51. When you get to to subsection 5, it says that the, if I'm reading this correctly, that the county is going to be required to share 40% of the proceeds of any vehicle registration fee with the cities. In your discussions, did it seem that the cities would be willing to concede or give up the spider web, knowing that county commissioners would be taking the hard votes on a tax increase and the cities would be benefiting by receiving 40% of the proceeds?
Madam Chair, Representative Call, my sense was I don't think we got into it that specifically, but that's something that certainly I think the counties would or the counties and cities probably would want to talk about. I mean, obviously, in a way, because the state doesn't get any cut of this; it goes to them. So it was kind of a discussion that I think they were trying to have. So,
thank you. And just lastly, I don't understand what subsection 7 does at all. I'm wondering if you can walk me through it.
In
section 51, subsection 7.
Yeah. Representative Beyer, this is existing law. So, I don't know, I can take a look and talk to people that may have been around when it was drafted, but yeah, it's...
I'll bug Patrick about it. You don't have to get into it. I was wondering how it related to the changes that were happening.
I'm sure there's a history behind it. We'll try to figure
that
out.
Yeah, and I didn't understand how it fit into the changes that were being made as well. So was trying to understand more fully how this all fit together with things that were changed.
Right.
So I'll bug this guy about that.
Okay.
And if I could, I just have one final question on 47 to 50, the freight bottleneck relief.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk to me about what relief looks like? Because I'm wondering how we're going to relieve the bottlenecks, because that could take on many different can look different depending on who's deciding what relief looks
sure.
like.
I think Chair Beyer, Representative Kai, a couple approaches here. We know we have an aging system. You have functionally obsolete tunnels, bridges, things that are barriers to the efficient movement of freight. Through the Oregon Freight Advisory Committee, we have documented that. We have charted that across the state, looking where those pinch points are. So I think we would address some aging infrastructure to make sure there's an efficient flow. I think we would use the Oregon Freight Advisory Committee to help vet this, to identify where those pinch points are across the whole of the transportation system, all the modes. We'd also ask the Area Commissions on Transportation to kind of put a regional lens down on it to help prioritize it. So, some of the things are just on the face of it. You kind of know your freight is now compromised. It can't navigate efficiently through a certain area. So that's kind of the initial look at it. There are different conversations about what the future holds. Again, as we look to the future, 20-some years out, it is anticipated that freight volumes will double. Are we looking at the capacity we have on the existing highway system or on the rail system? Can you anticipate where potential opportunities may be invested in the future to handle this tsunami of freight, as they say, it's coming at us? So I think it's that type of approach we're looking at. Again, currently what's in front of us, I think those are almost they're tangible right now. But again, how do we react as a transportation system to the future demands?
But just one final point.
Right.
Thank you. I'm sorry to
That's
occupy
okay.
so much time. I appreciate that. I'd just like to say, for the record, that my hope is that, if we look at where the bottlenecks occur, there are necessarily population centers where there are lots of people moving around. And I really hope that when we're looking at alleviating the bottlenecks, that transit is just at the forefront, at the top of the list of ways that we're going to be reducing people traveling on our highways rather than expanding capacity on those highways. Systems that would be my desire.
No, I think Chair Beyer, Representative Call, I know that was more of a statement, but again, we're tracking, to be very honest with you. Modal shifts are very important. What are the opportunities there, and the ability to make a robust investment in the transportation system where you offer people options so they could choose to get out of the car, number of single occupied vehicles or clogging up the roadways, freight struggles by getting through. But if we can migrate those folks to different modes, then I think we've addressed some capacity issues on the front of it. It is a comprehensive engagement to address the issue you broach.
And Representative Beyer, Representative Call, if I could add that the governor's transportation package, I think, takes a look at that issue that you raised in, through several different lenses. The investment in freight bottlenecks being one to deal with key needs that exist in the system today. I think the other piece that you saw that Chris talked about was the STIP stakeholder criteria that have been shifted and include some new questions for those groups to wrestle with. And finally, landing on a least cost planning model that would be developed with the department and other affected state agencies and local cities and counties over the next few years that would really begin to shift the way transportation decisions are made in this state so that the issue you just raised is the issue that is raised at the front end when folks are looking at a problem and how to address a problem and not just with additional capacity.
Thank you. And just a quick kind of reminder that this conversation is going to continue on to Wednesday with a lot of the stakeholders that were there participating in the discussions, and AOC will be here, and if you haven't gotten your answers from them beforehand, they'll be able to respond to those questions too. So, and Representative Bentz, and then Edwards, and then now Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think, Mr. Garnard, you may have touched upon my questions in your mention of Section 14 and also Section 17. 14, of course, talks about the criteria that have been used to select projects and then, quote, updating of them. That would suggest there's something that hasn't been working correctly under the current criteria for selection of projects. And I guess I need to ask what that would be and what these new criteria hope to accomplish. And I'll ask Madam Chair for opportunity to ask another question after. Yes, thank you.
Representative Beyer, Representative Bentz, something that isn't working. One of the moments of, I think, breakthrough that this committee process had that the governor initiated over the last year was early on in the process there was a recognition by many of the stakeholders that while the highway fund was very constricted and limited in its uses, it did not provide the funding necessary to address the backlog of problems. And in a roundabout way of getting to the answer of your questions, I think the STIP stakeholder criteria and the STIP criteria that is currently used is based on that constitutional limitation of the highway fund. The move toward least cost planning and inserting some different filters in interim projects criteria envision a transportation system that is funded across the board at a different level, where there is sustained investment in the non-highway section of the transportation system. So there is the ability to, if you are looking at an initial capacity problem or an initial bottleneck, to identify all of the potential solutions to that issue, whether they be increased investments in transit, where that's a viable option, whether that be some additional capacity for freight, whether that be improvements to a rail line. And so I believe that the way to answer that question is that there are some filters and some additional ideas for consideration in that STIP stakeholder criteria that look across modes, but also begin to factor in some environmental concerns that may not have been involved in that conversation before. Again, and to use a bad transportation analogy, this is really designed to be a bridge between the current conversation and the way that projects are selected in this state. Between that, the reality that we exist today, and the reality that is envisioned through a least cost planning scenario where you're able to crosswalk the factors of environmental concerns to be modally blind in terms of the solution that you're looking for and account for the environmental concerns in a way that has not been done currently.
Madam Chair, Representative Bentz, if I may, I think Hans is right. you ask the question, you know, what's broken, so to speak. I don't think anything's broken. It's just not complete. And Hans told you kind of how we'll animate and fully engage this issue. But right now, the criteria really focuses on modernization, capacity-type projects, preservation-type projects, bridge projects. Hans articulated a much greater engagement across the transportation solution. It is an effort that tries to bring a better integration of transportation, land use, and economic development, because those are lacking within that. So those 10 principles start to fulfill a greater perspective as we engage the planning efforts.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I should have begun my remarks by saying that this is an awful lot of work, and I appreciate you guys' hard work on it. And my comments are shallow when it comes to all the thinking you guys have done. So I just, when I read this, it looked to me as though it was a refocus of the funds on where most of the people are. And I viewed that also as I saw the regions called out. And it seemed to me that I wasn't focusing on such things as environmental allocation. I was looking more at geographic allocation and wondering if that's what you were about, and trying to design criteria that, of necessity, would focus more of our dollars on where most of the activity is occurring, which I think is probably happening now. But I'm just curious, that was not what you had in mind then. This was more of a global look at what we were doing, a broader, taking into account more environmental issues. Is that what you were about?
Chair Beyer, Representative Benz, I think the answer to your question is there was not a subplot or a nefarious way to funnel more money to the Portland metro region in the identification of this language. It really was looking at how do we begin to shift the thinking about transportation within the state of Oregon through an investment strategy that deals with all sectors of the transportation system in an ongoing and sustained manner. I think one of the things that Director Garrett touched on at the outset of this conversation is one of the five core principles that the governor delivered to this group when he set out and asked them to craft a package for his consideration was continued statewide investment. You know better than those of us sitting at the dais here the needs in your district and in parts of this state that are not as well traveled as others. Critical maintenance, preservation, and in some cases capacity needs, and I think the governor is committed to ensuring that whatever package moves through the legislative process and lands on his desk for signature accounts for that reality as well.
Thank you.
Follow up? Are you okay?
No.
Okay. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thanks for all your time and effort in bringing this package to the committee. My first question is kind of broader and philosophical in nature. Curious if you can explain the overriding philosophy regarding the balance of motor vehicle and alternative transportation investments. Was there some aspirational balance in terms of the percentage of resources devoted to those two categories?
Chair Beyer, Representative Edwards, throughout this process, again, as we were talking about how do we begin to shift the focus of the transportation conversation just from the highway portfolio to an ongoing investment in the non-highway portions of the transportation sector, there was some discussion of how certain federal formulas are used in terms of percentage of federal dollars and what percentage of federal dollars go toward the highway portfolio and the non-highway sector. There has been discussion of an aspirational goal of having 15% of the dollars that are spent on transportation or 20% or more going to the non-highway segment of the transportation system. What we struggled with is the reality of the fact that there is a fairly well-established funding mechanism for the road side of this equation. Currently, there is an excellent track record that many of you have laid in terms of incremental investment in the non-highway section with the Connect Oregon programs, and there is some commitment to the non-highway pieces outside of Connect Oregon in terms of bike and ped investments, but none of those have been done in a way that's ongoing. So there was an ongoing discussion within this committee and within the stakeholder group about how do we begin to shift that. Numbers around the 15% to 20% range were identified as targets. We were also working in a changing economic climate that made some of those aspirational goals difficult to achieve.
Thank you.
Representative Whitey.
Actually, I have a question.
Oh, yes.
Thank you.
Another question.
And a different topic altogether. I noted that about $50 million a year would be devoted to the Columbia River crossing. At this point, given the status of that project, what portion of our anticipated obligation to that project would that represent?
Right now, again, we're moving through the environmental process, looking to secure the final environmental document toward the end of the year. The $15 million starts to bring us equivalent to the investment the state of Washington has put into the game already. So the state of Washington has invested about $65 million. This just kind of brings the skin in the game equal, to be very honest with you.
Okay. Can I follow up?
Yep.
And just a comment. I mean, I appreciate the intention to revisit the STIP project criteria, especially in looking at economic development opportunities as a primary criterion. As you know, I represent Washington County, and we're going to run up against the transportation planning rule in siting a couple of businesses and industrial parks, especially during this economic period. I would hate to see our economic development efforts hindered by a lack of investment in the transportation infrastructure.
Thank you. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Might end up with a couple questions here, but when I sit and look at this and some of the stuff we're talking about, I can see the ACLU will probably be involved here shortly if we start deliberating on some of this stuff. But, I mean, not to oversimplify the package that you brought forth, but wouldn't it be better just to do a simple gas tax and have this body dedicate that goes into new highway projects to take care of the bottlenecks where we mandate or tell you guys where it needs to go so it doesn't get ate up in environmental impact studies, things like that? Because we have projects that are out there that we spend a lot of money on environmental impacts, and we're still not doing any. And now you're talking about starting new projects, so we have dream after dream after dream that we're paying for, and we're doing nothing. And I think that's what the taxpayers are upset about more than anything. So, and I think everybody knows my concern on that, being the Dundee bypass, spending over $11 million in environmental impact studies for a stretch of road that's 12 miles long. So,
Chair Beyer, Representative Widener, I think what there's a few things that we have to consider when you consider this package. The one of which is that the revenue scenario that was created for this funding package was envisioned at a time when gas was significantly higher in price than it is today. As it relates to the environmental work that is required on a lot of these projects, there is some extension in this bill of current environmental work and regulations that have been successful and successful actually in saving taxpayer dollars in terms of bundling permits in the OTIA programs that the governor would advocate moving forward to any funding that is approved with this bill. We also have to be cognizant of the reality of the federal requirements on those ends. Much of the work that is done by the state in preparation of those projects is required by the federal government, which I believe, and the director can correct me if I'm wrong, is where the Newburgh-Dundee project is at in its life cycle today.
Chair Beyer, Representative, that's correct. Newburgh-Dundee, again, because it has federal dollars associated, that has changed the complexion. So we must follow the prescriptive nature of the federal process just because we're spending their dollars. Those are the rules of the game as they exist right now.
But I'm just looking at a simplified package as far as taxing, rather than looking at, you know, like electric cars where people just pay $30 a month if they're driving an electric vehicle that's licensed, things like that for taxing electric vehicles. There's simpler ways to go about this than trying to get into people's personal property and invade on privacy that they would rather not let government know how much they're driving or where they're driving. That's where the vehicle mile or the gas mileage tax lets people, gives them a little bit of freedom there, and then if they just pay a flat monthly fee if they're driving an electric vehicle, it covers them there as well.
I think, Chair, by Representative Wyden, I think that's a legitimate policy issue that needs to be debated. Those are certainly the issues that have come forth in our work to date with regard to this transition to a vehicle mileage fee. But that would be you and your colleagues debating those type of things.
Follow-up? Another question? No? Okay. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question prompted by Representative Edwards' question. $50 million set aside for the Columbia River crossing, in the unlikely event that at some point we aren't able to coordinate by state, federal, local funding on that, what happens to that $15 million?
I guess Chair Beyer, Representative Bailey, if indeed there's no project, there's no need for the money. But let me assure you that the work being done to mature that project is we're moving forward. It's been productive. It will come. But again, if the project goes away, there's no need for the money.
Any follow-up? Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one last question came to mind. How do you see the state-sponsored package in relation to the federal stimulus package?
Chair Beyer, Representative Edwards, I see it as the next wave. I look at the federal dollars that came to the state of Oregon, specific to transportation now, as a jolt, an economic jolt to create jobs, to put jobs on the ground. It will also help make for a healthier transportation infrastructure. Those projects, again, if we start to work right now, I think there's the first wave to engage that effort. What I see with the Jobs and Transportation Act is a significant long-term or sustainable flow of money, not only to the highway portfolio, which will make it healthier, but also to the various modes to provide people options with regard to transportation. So I see them linked. There is no question. One, again, the intent, I believe, of the federal stimulus was to invest that money as quickly as possible. I think that came from the President, and I think that was the congressional intent, commence expending immediately. So let us go there, and then the longer-term opportunities will present themselves if, indeed, we animate the Jobs and Transportation Act.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
So in addition to the difference in timing, are there projects different in nature or scope?
I think Representative Edwards, Chair Beyer, due to the nature of the timing, a significant amount of the projects that are being funded or are being considered for funding under the federal stimulus dollars are maintenance and preservation projects that are a little bit lower on the environmental work and have the ability to put boots on the ground and paychecks in Oregonians' pockets as fast as possible. I would see that funding stream taking care of some of the needs being the key word there, I believe, in the maintenance and preservation system management of the department at the state level at this time.
Chair Beyer, Representative, one other thing that just to kind of close this, one of the things that is good about the stimulus package, we're going to be getting people out to work now. You're going to be seeing people. You're going to be seeing signs basically saying people are working. They're making these investments. So as you go back to your constituents and say, well, gee, they've got all this money. What are they doing with it? Well, we're actually doing things. You'll see, you know, roads all over the state. You'll see actually people out there making those improvements. So I think what you can say with confidence is that we're spending the money, and we're spending it, you know, in good things that are preserving the system, making it safer, and actually there's also some pieces that make the system, you know, expand the system as well. So we are doing some really good things with those dollars, and so I think you can feel confident going back to your constituents saying, listen, we're spending that money and we're putting people to work. So.
Well, I don't see any. I guess I have a couple comments. First one is to remind people that we are having more of the stakeholders coming next Wednesday, or this coming Wednesday, and they'll be able to expound on some of the pieces that you've picked out and have questions on. So there is that. There's just this little one here I wanted to ask you about, and it is the encourage use of electric vehicles, Section 19. Mm-hmm. And having a couple concerns about providing this for the state workers. I can see providing the facilities for people to plug their cars in, and I think that in general this isn't a bad policy to go to for the state, but I would hope it would be for everybody. Plus, you also have the issue of this probably being during the probably prime high energy use period that you're going to be looking at plugging in vehicles. So that's a little bit of a concern. So, and I know all of this is subject to, you know, a little bit of tinkering and trying to figure out the policy, but I think we have to be careful in, you know, if we're not, I guess, prioritizing certain groups over other groups. I think it needs to be something that everybody is able to use.
And Chair Beyer, I think you're exactly correct. The language included in this bill is based on an experience that Washington State had where they tried to install some plugs in some of their state buildings for the public when they were coming. So at Department of Human Services, for example, when folks were showing up for services or showing up for appointments or at the state capitol building or those types of instances, and that is how it was envisioned in its inclusion in the governor's transportation package.
And a little in response to that, was it a free service or was this a metered service that people paid for? Do you have that information?
I believe at this point it was a free service in the state of Washington.
And obviously, Chair Beyer, is if there's a, you know, a plethora of electric cars that show up, then, you know, I think the policy would be revisited. I think it just enables the agency to be able to do it. So I think it's more just to kind of have that incentive and to encourage them.
Okay. And not having stimulated any other questions.
Representative Beyer, I just wanted to take the opportunity to thank the committee again for taking the time to hear the bill today. Clearly, there were numerous ideas included in the drafting of this legislation. The governor's office and the governor, we would be remiss if we did not thank the group of stakeholders behind us. Many of the ideas included in this bill were worked out by them in incredibly good faith. When we started this process nearly 18 months ago, I think there was a palpable fear that this could have quickly turned into a monkey knife fight. To their credit, it did not. We had an incredibly productive and honoring process by which those folks engaged in a very difficult conversation, set aside some preconceived notions, and we believe, and the governor believes, put together a transportation package that you can consider that will both protect and continue to improve the transportation system in the state of Oregon, but as we are in the times that we are in, put people to work. So thank you, and as always, any of us are available to any of you outside of this hearing framework should you have questions about specifics of the bill.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming. Committee, we have still a little bit of time, and given that one of the members that could not come Wednesday to present his view of the process, if you'll indulge me, we'll go ahead and call him up, Paul Romain, and just want to make sure that I'm not showing any preferences when I call him up in front of everybody else. So,
Madam Chair, I know you like me best, and thank you.
I have your spiel memorized. That's probably why.
That's true. I repeat it quite often.
Yes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romain. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I'm here representing the Oregon Petroleum Association. And I'm here to talk about one aspect of this process, and that's obviously the gas tax. And I'm here to talk about it a little differently than we would normally talk about it. Usually you find a user group that's sitting there saying, don't tax us, don't tax us, don't tax us. And actually you've heard that from me periodically over other issues. We are... But the gas tax is a user tax. It's actually fairly well conceived. If you use the road, you pay for use of the road. It's a little different than a lot of the other taxes out there. The problem with the gas tax right now is that we have two different sort of levels of government that do the gas tax, or three, actually. We have the federal government, we have the state government, and then we have local jurisdictions. From the Petroleum Association's standpoint, the local gas tax is a nightmare. It's not the amount of the tax, it's the fact that it balkanizes the whole taxing structure. You have jurisdictions like Eugene that have a 5-cent tax, yet Lane County has zero. You have other jurisdictions that have 3-cent, there's a penny and a half in Tillamook, they're all over the place. Not only do you have to track the various jurisdictions and account for everything that's in those, sold within those jurisdictions, but it becomes a competitive problem. For example, if you own a station in Lane County and you're competing against a station in the city of Eugene, you have a 5-cent advantage on how you price your product. It may not be reflected in the street price of the product because you have to make a competitive decision of what you do about that additional expense. Again, it's not the 5 cents that we object to. It's the pockmark, basically, state that has these different taxes. So what we've been proposing is that you increase the gas tax a considerable amount, and you dedicate a portion of that to your local governments. In return, you do away with the local government fuel tax. Let me explain a little further. And first, let me back up a little bit. We are always looking to improve the system. We actually participated willingly in the vehicle mile travel, the VMT program. We did it not because we support it. We just didn't know anything about it. So we were willing to be participants to see if it worked. And frankly, probably the most conservative member of our organization was the one who actually participated in it. So it was to get data for the state so that rational decisions could be made. Currently, right now, we are about 13.5 cents below Washington State in their statewide gas tax. They made the bold move of increasing their tax and putting it out there, and they have projects going on all the time. So we have a little room to deal with. We don't, as long as we're reasonably competitive with Washington State, we're fine with gas taxes. It's a user fee. You're going to pay it. It's not one of those things where you're going to buy down because, frankly, there is nothing to buy down to. You are going to use the product. So what we are proposing is to put an additional, say, 4 cents per gallon onto the statewide gas tax, dedicate it 100% to cities and counties. That raises about $110 to $120 million annually, depending on how you calculate which figures you're using today. But say it's $110 million. Currently, when you take all of the local gas taxes together, they raise $16 million. So we're not talking about taking money away from local jurisdiction. We're trying to get them more money. In return, you do two things. One of them is you phase out the existing gas taxes by taking a portion of, say, $16 million of the current of the revenue you would raise and give it, feed it back in on a slow basis or whatever basis you want to satisfy those jurisdictions that currently have a tax, and take the rest of it and split it up any way you want to with the local jurisdictions. You give it to them, you let them apply it to local projects, because we believe that is something that the people, the voters, will actually go for. In addition, you could keep the 2-cent gas tax that is in the governor's package. That's divided a little differently. We're not telling you to take away anything, but in return, we have to have that phase out and then a ban on any future local government taxes on fuel. We're trying to be part of a solution here. We're trying to come up with a rational way to get money to jurisdictions that need it. Local governments need the money. We don't dispute that with them. What we're talking about is how you get them the money, what's the best way to do it, and we believe that the local gas tax is not the way to do it, but a statewide gas tax divided properly is the way to do it. Be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Representative Schaffler.
Yeah, thank you. Paul, I think your words, I wrote them down verbatim, I think. Quote, voters will actually go for, unquote. That's the package I'm looking for. And I'll tell you, and I'm kind of putting you on the spot. There's a lot of industry out here, and I want them to be on the spot, too, not just you. We need a broad-based support for this, Republican, Democrat, industry, the people that use the roads, AAA, and local government. You know, the more we have on board, the better. But I tell you, I'm going to vote for some package, and I want to have everybody who has a vested interest in this, which is all of us, to get up and fight those ornery, miserable, anti-government bustards that may well refer this onto the ballot and say, no, 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 there they go again. And I tell you, I've seen it time and again. Now, in 2003, we passed, with your help, a substantial, and the industry's help, a substantial increase in fees. And we've seen the benefits of that and the improvements in our infrastructure, and it did not get referred, and I'm grateful for that. I got a stack of mail bashing me over the head voting for it, but that's a different story, and I don't mind that. But I really want to know, or I hope in the days and weeks and months to come, that kind of support is made loud and clear from the industry that, yes, they are going to get out in front of this, are going to help us get a broad base of support, Republican and Democrat, and hopefully head off a referral. And if we don't, that there'll be millions and millions of dollars in a fight to keep it as we pass out of here. And I don't know if I'm going to get all that, but that's maybe what it takes. I'm not sure, but I just want to get that out there because we need something that the voters will actually go for.
Madam Chair, Representative Schaufler, I couldn't agree with you more. I've basically been preaching this message for the last year or year and a half that this has to be a bipartisan effort. It basically has to be across the board. It can't be a number of Democrats and no Republicans, or a few Republicans or a bunch of Republicans and a few Democrats. It has to be a pretty bipartisan group that does it. The beauty of what I think I'm proposing is that I believe it stays in this building, because not only are you doing you're taxing, which is the kind of, God, I don't want that, but you're also getting rid of something. And so it's an interesting package where those who are opposed to a gas tax can say, I got rid of a gas tax. And those who are for a gas tax can say, I got a gas tax. So you're both giving and taking at the same time, yet it gets a lot more money. And it gets it in a fairly painless way. Right now, tonight, after I leave you here, I'm driving to the city of Springfield to refer their gas tax. They're passing a gas tax. I am supposed to be on the agenda tonight, and then tomorrow I've got all the papers to refer it. I don't want to refer it. I've put on a lot of miles going around the state to refer them. When we get them on the ballot, they end up losing. We can keep this thing off the ballot. We can keep it in the building. We've been in conversations with folks who are very interested in this, both from a I want the money and from a no money should go out to anybody standpoint. And I believe very strongly we can keep this in the building. And this would be a good way to fund local transportation needs. They need the money. They need the help. Thank you.
I'm seeing no other questions. I think that's the cities and counties' idea, is to keep you on the road, increasing the revenue from gas tax, right?
I also bought a smart car, so it's not that much revenue.
With that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 2120. And committee, we're continuing invited testimony on Wednesday, and on Friday we'll have open testimony from the public. So anybody who's interested can sign up and talk to us. With that, we are adjourned.